From Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is a special edition of Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. I want to give you a content warning. In the spirit of Sexual Assault Awareness Month, we're bringing back conversations we recorded during the release of Cap Radio's After the Assault podcast, which explores what survivors experience in the aftermath of sexual violence and during police investigations. We're going to lead with an important resource. You can call the National Sexual Assault Hotline at 800-656-HOPE. The reality is you probably know someone who's a survivor. Roughly 44% of women and a quarter of men have experienced sexual violence. One in two transgender people are sexually abused or assaulted at some point in their lifetimes. And those numbers don't include the many people who don't report. Our first conversation focuses on the disproportionate challenges communities of color face when it comes to reporting sexual assault to law enforcement. For survivors of color, the numbers go up, but the data isn't as clear-cut. Reverend Elaine Whitefeather has created and resurrected over 40 domestic violence programs across the country and globe, including the former nonprofit domestic violence provider, A Community for Peace in Sacramento County. Elaine spoke with me about the barriers that exist for marginalized and vulnerable communities and how she drew from her own experiences to help support other survivors on their healing journey. Elaine, in your experience, why is it harder for people of color to report sexual assault? What are the barriers?
I think the overall understanding of sexual assault within communities of color and for survivors like myself is that we don't often understand that sexual assault occurs in the context of a greater oppression lens with which communities of color must live every day. So when you consider the intersection of systems with those of us from these communities, including our LGBTQ community, which has an extraordinary higher rate of sexual assault, which never goes reported or even spoken about, really. When you think about that intersection just on a daily basis, and I think over this past year, it has been exposed what that level of oppression is on a daily basis. So sexual assault occurs within that context. And so when you're thinking about that, then you're thinking about all those systems with which trust is broken already from a day-to-day experience. And so then you have something that is extraordinarily holistically, soulfully violating. And then you have to think twice, two or three or four times about not just reporting it, but what's going to happen to you throughout the whole journey of the system that's going to end up with no justice. So if that is your everyday experience, then why would you go take yourself through that again? And so for many of us, it's easier for us to find our own women who are survivors like us, who look like us, who have our experience, and who understand our fear of law enforcement, our fear of even responders, whether they're EMT or first responders, who don't even look like us. If I am a trans woman, I am terrified every day of my life. I'm a queer elder of four races, all of the ones you named, Asian, Native American, Black, and I'm queer. And I'm 69 years old. I'm a survivor of multiple sexual assaults, and not one of them did I ever report for these reasons.
And thank you just for laying out the systemic barriers that exist. It's also taboo in many cultures and in society to even talk about sex in areas like sexual assault. So there's a stigma there. How does that barrier inhibit reporting and the conversations with people that can help them?
Absolutely, that the internal barriers are cultural indeed. And they're again rooted also in a greater dominant culture with which your culture knows you do not have equity. And so inside of that, we keep it quiet. You know, my mom said to me, don't let your father find out about this. Why? Because she knows his rage or his outrage, which would be justified of something happening to a 16-year-old daughter, would get him more likely in jail for his outrage than I would get help. So we keep it in the family and we try to take care of it inside ourselves, only we're not, because the entire family is traumatized. And the secrecy and this quietness also adds to the burden of guilt and shame that a survivor carries her whole life And then I think sometimes we overcompensate in the way we end up parenting, like we're overly controlling and over dominating or over protective. And I don't know that generationally that really helps our young daughters or our young sons or our young gay kids understand what's going to happen. So that openness of conversation is what I appreciate, even what we're doing here. Open the conversation. And those of us who are survivors of color, it is our voices that become important to say there are safer places.
The fact that these issues and these barriers stay from generation to generation, how has this evolved or changed over the years and decades?
One of the things I'm appreciating right now, and maybe, you know, I don't know if this is a result of COVID. I don't know if this is a result of, you know, the intensification of issues because we were all sort of, you know, isolated and then it kind of amplified, right? But what I'm really appreciating is that there are more and more of us, women of color, who are coming forward to say, me too. This is my story. Please don't be afraid. We are here with you, sister survivors. I think more of us that are women of color who are highlighted and on the front lines of responding like Community for Peace is trying to do, then I think that's going to start to get the conversation. But there are so many more celebrities, high profile women, Senator Rubio, who here in California, who has ushered in so much and lately in the last few years of legislation that's now law here in California, is cutting edge. As a Latina, she has done fierce work. And so I think more folks of us who can say this without carrying the cultural shame, but really saying we need to break through with some truth. This is not us. Offenders make victims. Victims don't make victims. And we got to shake that cloak off of us and that mask off of us and stop taking responsibility for sanctuary harm, which is the systemic racism and issues that are already institutionalized, and stop, you know, moving around. Just call it what it is and be brave enough to stand out. Be brave enough to have these conversations.
You know, when we started our conversation, we went through, you know, really striking statistics within communities of color. How does this issue and these barriers and the stigma surrounding reporting sexual assault vary within communities of color?
I think a lot of it depends personally from myself with personal relationships you end up with having. A good cop, a good social worker, a good first responder of any sort, just one can make a difference, right? And so when people ask me what needs to happen, I think if in all of these systems, the people who respond to sexual assault are volunteers, you know, like law enforcement, like, this is what I want to do. This is my heart. And this is my passion. So I will study it. I will learn it. I will want to really get involved and see it from the inside out. If you had volunteers on your police department, if you had volunteers, not just a paid job, but you have passion for it, like many of us credible missioners, we are here because we get it. We got what was wrong. So if you have volunteers. And then the second part, that your responders look like the people who are being assaulted, and you can do that. And the third part is, if you look like the people and you are like the people, then you're a part of that community already. You have credibility from the inside out. You're not just responding. You are part of the community. And then lastly, I think the training for all of our responders should have this oppression lens. Not to feel guilty and bad, but to have deeper understanding of the layers and complexity of trauma that happens to a sexual assault survivor when she is a person, he or she or they are people of color. That is just, it's like layers and layers and layers. But if you understand that, then your approach is going to be different. And the way you move folks through the system, and they'll be more encouraged to go side by side with someone who's going to walk with them, who has also been through the system successfully or found that ally, because there are those. I don't want to say the whole system's, you know, it doesn't work. It could work, but we weren't even willing to give it a try because we have these barriers already. So if the systems could understand and the systems could sensitize themselves instead of just using academics, but culturally sensitize themselves, then I think we have a shot.
You briefly touched upon the transgender community and the heightened risk and the heightened apprehension of reporting sexual violence. When it comes to men, what about destigmatizing sexual assault experienced by men?
I think we have to destigmatize it with everyone right now. Every single person is still carrying the stigma of it because we are still in a culture of victim blaming. And if we can flip that narrative, then I think more of us also will be able to say this is our experience. But as long as we're just focusing so much on what happens to the victim and not what happens to the criminal, we don't think of this as a crime. We're still thinking of it as sex, and it is not. It's a crime. It's an absolute violent, heinous, holistic, traumatic crime that one never, ever, ever, ever gets over. You just find a place for it in your story of your nightmare part of your life, and it changes you forever. You don't get to go back. So I think that it's a huge thing, really. There's no one track to do this, but I do think that the more all of us are allowed to be at the table, if all of us as credible messengers who are survivors of color can be heard and believed that our experience isn't the same as someone else's experience, if you are a dominant culture, you're going to get more opportunity than we will ever imagine having. And if we could be believed about that, I think that we could start to do something instead of folks getting defensive and trying to defend that. There's nothing to defend. We're just like saying, and here's this. And so if you could let our and be part of the conversation, I think we together might make something happen.
For survivors who choose not to report to law enforcement, and that's a very individual choice, you know, when you're talking about the and part, how do we incorporate that and within communities where it's hard for survivors to come forward and they need that support?
Well, again, we have wonderful organizations. Weave is one of them, and several of them all across the world. But there are a lot of those of us who are not official rape crisis centers who are filled with survivors just like me. And if you will just reach out and look, I'll say to every survivor, no matter what, you have the right to interview who helps you too, you know? So if you don't like the vibe or you don't like the feel of that advocate or that helper, that you get to find another person who does. And there we are here. We're all out here. So I say just start with a crisis line call. Start with a help call. Just get some information. Feel the vibe yourself. You're so sensitive right now to power and control and power and privilege. You'll feel the vibe. Trust that inside yourself. When you can feel that someone like, okay, they might get me, then just start there. You never know. It might lead you to filing a report one time. You never know. But don't think that that's what you have to do. Think that you deserve to have someone understand what has just happened to you. Think about reaching out to have one of your sisters or brothers walk you through this. You don't have to do this alone. You were violated alone. You cannot heal alone. We will walk with you forever because we are survivors. We understand this is a forever thing. So find that organization. There are plenty of us around. Plenty, plenty, plenty. But you have to go look for them. Never assume that just because someone says they can do this, that they know how. Maybe they know how with that group of people, but maybe not with you. So go interview, find the help you deserve to have. You deserve to have. Don't just take any old help. Take the help that's going to help you.
That was my conversation with Reverend Elaine Whitefeather. To learn more about the support organizations Elaine referred to or about the steps in the legal reporting process, go to capradio.org/after. Up next, our conversation on how the trauma of sexual assault affects your brain. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Before we begin, I want to give you a content warning. In the spirit of Sexual Assault Awareness Month, we're revisiting our conversations from Cap Radio's After the Assault podcast that explores what survivors experience in the aftermath of sexual violence and during police investigations. We're going to spend time learning about how sexual assault and trauma affects the brain and how knowing this can support survivors on their healing journey. I spoke with Marianne Candela, a trauma educator, advocate, and host of That's a Mindful podcast, which focuses on the intricacies of trauma with the goal of better understanding our brain. During our conversation, we also heard from one of the survivors who took part in Cap Radio's podcast after the assault. Starting off, tell us about your own personal experience and expertise.
Sure, absolutely. So I started as an educator in about 2015 and was introduced to this idea of trauma-informed practices. And so what that really kind of examined is looking at the behaviors of our students through a trauma-informed lens, which is a student misbehaving or is a student experiencing a trauma? Through that discovery, I couldn't help but apply it to my own life, right? So I continued on with this experience in my teaching practices and this knowledge and just continuing to explore more, do more research. And then in 2018, I actually experienced a traumatic brain injury. And so that TBI really kind of shook up my reality, my ability to function, my ability to interact and engage with the world as I had previously known. And so what I turned to as, you know, a coping response was, I need to understand what's happening in my brain. I need to know what's happening in my body. And I need to understand how every trauma I have experienced in my life up until this point now is impacting my healing. And so that was kind of the motivation for beginning this podcast, continuing the research, understanding the sympathetic nervous system, our brain cognition, and the way that things function when we are hyper aroused and in a trauma response or trauma brain state.
You know, when listening to the podcast after the assault, I mean, they make an important distinguish between the difference between the words survivor and victim. Can you help us understand that?
So when we're in or experience a traumatic event, right, automatically what people assume is that there's this kind of brokenness or there's this damage that has been done. But those that study trauma also understand that you can't have or experience trauma without also cultivating and experiencing resilience. And so, you know, Sammy does a great job at identifying these survivors, and even the survivors speak to their own, you know, reference to themselves. I am surviving this. This is something that happened. It didn't end me. So every day that someone who has experienced trauma gets up and makes a conscious decision to move forward, even if that conscious decision is staying in their bed for the day, you're still surviving what happened to you. So the term survivor is so important to support, to validate, and affirm that something awful happened and you are surviving it every moment.
Well, we're going to be focusing on episode 2, and that is titled Your Brain on Rape. Can you explain what happens in our brains when we experience trauma like a sexual assault?
Yeah, absolutely. So you had alluded to that in your introduction about, you know, the fight, flight, or freeze kind of, you know, automatic response that happens. And so our brains are very, you know, they're very animalistic. They're the most reptilian part of our brain is the part that tells us whether or not we are safe. And so the sensory information that we can take in a single moment is almost infinite, right? Like our brain accepts, receives, and decodes all of this information. However, as soon as you go into your fight or flight mode or survival mode, as people say, there's a switch that flips in our brain. And so what that switch does is it turns off any of our executive functioning, any of our ability to think of ourselves, make critical decisions, any kind of, you know, analysis or self-reflection, all of that stuff goes offline. And what happens is our survival brain or our animal brain kicks in and it starts pumping all of this blood to our limbs, to our heart, and to our lungs so that we can either fight or run, right? And so what happens when you experience trauma is a very primal reaction. But when you're experiencing a traumatic event, your brain can't tell whether or not you're in the woods trying to defend yourself from a bear, right? Or if you're at home where you should feel safe, or with friends supporting you where you should feel safe, but you still don't. So that's kind of the impact of toxic stress, like experiencing a sexual assault. In the trauma world, we call that a big T trauma. It's a single event. But what can happen after that is re-traumatization. So you're bringing it up, you're telling the story. If you report, sometimes that whole process can be re-traumatizing. So you're really extending that stress response. And so all those, you know, moment-to-moment experiences that happen in our body are good for a single moment, but if it continues to extend, that stress becomes toxic. And we start losing memories, we start losing, you know, sensory awareness, all of that stuff kind of just goes out the window, and our normal quote unquote brain function goes offline.
We're going to get into this, into how this impacts cognition and brain function. First, I'm going to play an excerpt from After the Assault. Annie is a survivor, and she's sharing her experience with memory following her sexual assault.
Well, after the phone call that I had with the sergeant, she said, "I will not even consider assigning this to a detective until you write me a detailed statement of everything that happened." So it took me weeks to write that, because it took me weeks, and I was like crying, and I couldn't, like, I didn't want to think about it. That was just like re-traumatizing, even having to do that, especially with the pressure of feeling like I had to set things up, you know, details and the way things were coming back to me. It, you know, it wasn't an easy thing to do, but I did it.
You know, and I think it's just important to state that, you know, it's deeply personal and it's different for every single individual. But Marianne, with your expertise, can you just help us unpack a little what Annie went through?
Absolutely. So I think what's really important to note here is that our brains are really, really smart. And the way that our brains protect us and care for us is ancient. So what ends up happening is, you know, your limbic system is the response system to the trauma. And so you've got your amygdala that does the fight, flight, or freeze, right? And then you've got the hypothalamus that sends all the, you know, the neurochemicals that are releasing adrenaline and cortisol and all of that stuff. Well, your hippocampus and your thalamus are responsible for collecting information, collecting data during that time. And they go offline completely. So what she experienced was her brain going into the driver's seat and her brain saying, in this moment, I know that you are unsafe. In this moment, I know that your fear response, your fight response, or your flight response are all activated. So I'm going to shut down any data collection, right? We're not going to retrieve any sensory information, sight, sound, smells, because it's going to be too much overload for your brain to process. And the hippocampus is really good at protecting our consciousness from remembering the things that were harmful. So it's actually a protective mechanism that happens. And oftentimes what happens is way later, you know, we learn about this sometimes, or we see this in movies and stuff, like the, you know, childhood memory that comes back, or the, you know, push down, you know, put away thing that we can't recall in that moment. And we're not going to recall, because when our physical body is still in stress mode, our brain is smart enough to know this information is too much for us right now. So it's not until maybe years later after healing or getting yourself self-regulated and into a calm, safe state that those memories or those details will be retrievable.
I mean, that brings us to, I'm going to play one last excerpt from Annie. I mean, she describes the moment she remembered a significant detail in her assault. The person had a gun to her back. This was also weeks after reporting the assault to law enforcement. And she describes how she felt when detectives got back to her. Let's take a listen.
It was as if it was my fault that I didn't remember the gun right away because of how it would appear. And that was even said in the phone conversation. Yeah, I felt like I was just extremely like cross-examined on the phone. Like, why didn't you remember a gun? That's like a really important thing. And like, I couldn't explain why I couldn't remember things that had happened or why they were coming back to me the way that they did. And the only reason I was able to not feel like a crazy person in that situation, because I feel like the tone and the way I was being spoken to, if I hadn't been through 10 years of therapy, or if I hadn't known what trauma does to someone's brain, that I would have completely felt in that moment that everything I was saying and thinking and doing was wrong.
Mm-hmm. Marianne, from the lens of a survivor, what are you hearing from Annie?
You know, the one thing that I try to emphasize in my trauma work, working with all survivors, is it is the utmost critical, important action of believing a survivor. And what I was hearing is her isolation, self-doubt, self-judgment, criticism that comes from a place of not being heard or seen. And when you experience trauma, you can feel like a crazy person because there's things happening in your mind, your body that you can't explain and doesn't make any sense to you because, like I mentioned before, it's happening kind of behind the scenes, right? And so her experience is so relatable to survivors of any trauma because you can't explain or describe what's happening in your brain. You just need someone to bear witness.
That was my conversation with Marianne Candela, a trauma educator, advocate, and host of That's a Mindful podcast. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. If you're just joining us, we're revisiting conversations that were part of CAP Radio's After the Assault Reporting Project, which examined what survivors experience in the aftermath of sexual violence and during police investigations. There really is no real timeline for healing after experiencing a traumatic event, and that includes sexual assault. It often depends on a survivor's situation, the resources they have access to, and the support network around them. What's important to understand is that there are serious mental health impacts caused by sexual violence. A study authored by our next guest, Dr. Emily DeWorken, explored the risk of mental disorders in people who've experienced sexual assault compared to those who haven't. Diagnoses ranged from anxiety disorder, depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, and substance abuse. But arguably the most striking finding, almost half of sexual assault survivors have considered dying by suicide. My colleague Randall White spoke with Dr. DeWorken, who is a clinical psychologist at the University of Washington School of Medicine. They talked about what causes traumatic stress, tools loved ones can use to help survivors improve their mental health, and how law enforcement and other agencies can minimize harm.
One of the goals of the After the Assault podcast is to, you know, help with finding justice and finding, you know, roads to recovery. What are some of the proven tools that help with this trauma post-sexual assault?
Yeah, so there's some tools that we think about in terms of what survivors can do for themselves and what their loved ones can do to support them. And then there's also certain tools that are especially effective when you're seeking therapy. So there's specific kinds of therapies that are intended to help with post-traumatic stress disorder. And these therapies have very high success rates, such that most people that complete these therapies, which are about 12 sessions typically, no longer meet criteria for PTSD at the end. So I can speak to tools in any of those domains.
Mm-hmm. Well, Professor, I'm wondering, do you have data that shows people who go through these programs, you know, are successful at a certain rate versus people that try to go it on their own?
Yeah, so what we normally see is that we do see this period of natural recovery where a lot of people will get better with no intervention. But once PTSD becomes chronic, so once it's been in place for months or even years, it is somewhat unlikely for it to just go away on its own, although that does tend to happen from time to time. What we see in people getting these therapies is really high rates of remission of the disorder. Mm-hmm. So these therapies do tend to work better than doing nothing, and they also tend to work better than what we would consider kind of general unstructured talk therapy. So therapies that last maybe years and don't involve specifically targeting the disorder or using a process that's proven to help with this disorder.
I imagine that there are triggering agents also that bring back the trauma to overwhelming points. What might some of those be?
Yeah, so first I want to distinguish between bringing back the trauma itself and bringing up the traumatic stress that's resulting from the trauma. So oftentimes we talk about those things in the same way, but one of the things I want to emphasize is that the traumatic event ends when the event is over, and then the traumatic stress is what lingers over time. But when a survivor is reminded of the assault, it can really feel like they're back in the situation where the event itself is happening. And that is their brain's natural alarm system kind of setting off this alarm and telling them that they're in a dangerous situation, because it has sort of encoded all these things that remind your brain of the assault with the sense of danger. I sort of think of it like when you have a smoke detector that goes off when you take a shower, your brain sort of becomes that kind of alarm system that's over attuned to cues that might represent risk.
And what are some of the triggering agents that might make this happen? Could a conversation like the one we're having right now, could this be a triggering agent?
Yeah, so one of the things that's important to keep in mind about triggers when we're thinking about people with PTSD, triggers can be literally anything that reminds them of the assault or of the feelings associated with it. So it can include people that look a certain way. It can include being in a certain setting. It can include just thinking about what happened or talking about what happened. I've treated people for PTSD that were triggered by certain types of deodorant or certain perfumes. There is no one size fits all trigger, and it's so individual to the person and their assault experience. And without knowing the details from their perspective, it's really hard to anticipate what would be triggering.
That's interesting about the perfume or deodorant. The power of olfactory senses really can bring you back to a moment, hopefully a positive moment, but in this case, not. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and we're speaking with Emily Dworkin, a clinical psychologist in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at the University of Washington School of Medicine. And this discussion is part of Insight's collaboration with CAP Radio's After the Assault podcast. So, Professor, I'm curious, people in survivors' lives, what can they do to support them? Because as we know, the numbers are really high for those who have experienced this, but there are so many others who surround these people. What's their best path in dealing with the situation?
Absolutely. So I tell supporters of survivors to be a person to whom the survivor knows they can go for compassion when they're experiencing difficult thoughts and feelings, because we know that the trauma of sexual assault is sort of like an emotional wound where it hurts to change the bandage, it hurts to clean it out, but sort of airing it out is what helps with the healing process. But it's really important that it be aired out in a safe environment, just like you wouldn't want to clean a wound with dirty water. You also don't want to air out trauma in a setting where people are going to be unsupportive to you. Mm. So the more people survivors have in their social community that they can go to for compassion and that sort of airing out process, the better. And supporters can really show that they care through supportive listening, which includes focusing on the survivor. So listening attentively, putting away your phone and other distractions, keeping the focus on what they're saying about their thoughts and emotions instead of, you know, thinking about what you're going to say next or other topics. And then trying to really understand their perspective. So ask questions that help you understand what they're thinking and feeling. Repeat back in your own words what they told you and ask them if you got it right. And use what you learned to put yourself in their shoes. And then finally, and perhaps most importantly, acknowledge that their perspective is valid. So explain why you think their thoughts and emotions are understandable given their situation, even if your thoughts and emotions would be different, and tell them that you think what they're experiencing is difficult, painful, scary, et cetera.
Let's talk a little bit about timelines. I imagine that some people, even supporters, might say, hey, it's been this long since that happened. You should be at this point by now. But there really are no timelines, right?
There really are no timelines, and it's really individual, and it really depends on survivors' situation and the resources that they have access to. And for many survivors, the mental health effects may last months or years. But what I really want to emphasize is that the mental health effects are treatable disorders by and large. And we have really great evidence-based therapies that are really successful at resolving the disorders that result from sexual assault. In fact, both of the evidence-based treatments for PTSD were originally developed for sexual assault survivors. And so we know that these are really kind of intended and meant to help with the trauma of sexual assault, or the traumatic stress resulting from sexual assault, even though they're used now widely for a variety of different types of trauma.
Mm-hmm. We talked about the supporters that may be in your life who can help you and be a resource to talk to. But, you know, immediately following the sexual assault, or at least along the way, there are many professionals that survivors need to talk to, including the police and lawyers and therapists. How might those people do a better job in minimizing the harm?
Yeah, so I think that they can take the same skills that I just mentioned in the supportive listening arena and really focus on giving the survivor a degree of autonomy and choice where possible. So it's not always possible in systems, like the police can't always give survivors a choice in what happens next, or prosecutors can't always give survivors a choice, but at least explaining what's going on and why it's happening and when there are opportunities for choice, giving those choices to the survivor and doing their best to express compassion and listen supportively rather than expressing judgment or minimizing or trying to kind of fix the situation just in that conversation. Because of course we can't change the fact that an assault happened. We can only support the survivor after it.
That was my colleague Randall White in conversation with Emily DeWorkin, a clinical psychologist at the University of Washington School of Medicine. If you or someone you know has experienced sexual assault and needs help, you can call the National Sexual Assault Hotline at 800-656-HOPE. To hear and learn more, you can also visit capradio.org/after. There you'll find our entire podcast series and resources. Still ahead, we talk about how to be an ally for a survivor of sexual assault. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Throughout the hour, we've been discussing sexual assault, and this might not be suitable for everyone. In the spirit of Sexual Assault Awareness Month, we're revisiting our conversations from Cap Radio's After the Assault podcast that explores what survivors experience in the aftermath of sexual violence and during police investigations. We're closing the hour with support. When a loved one comes to you in the aftermath of sexual assault, how can you be a good ally? I spoke with Carissa Gutierrez, who is a former communications director for Valorus, a national nonprofit that is working to end sexual violence. We spoke about the importance of letting each individual tell their story and the importance of making sure they know you believe them. What we've learned throughout the podcast series After the Assault is through the stories of survivors, each individual experiences. But expanding beyond that, this is also a societal issue. If you can discuss that and expand on that, especially addressing rape culture.
Absolutely, Vicki. I think that's a pretty loaded question when we try to understand sort of the forces at work that allow for sexual violence to happen in the first place. And as far as what are those conditions that we talk about, or whether it's systemic or institutional versus individual, the answer is that it's both, right? At the end of the day, it's an individual who's making that decision, but they are impacted by the information or the way they interact with their environment. So much of the way that we absorb information, the lessons that we learn in our media, in our culture, in our family experiences, inform the way we interact with individuals in our own lives. So in order for us to be better supporters of people who have experienced sexual violence, it really does kind of come from all directions. So there are examples that could be better modeled, but they're also the way we treat one another.
Right. And really, the foundation of allyship is really just a genuine desire to be there for someone you love following trauma. But you also might be feeling kind of out of your element when it comes to the right way to be there. So what's the first step in bridging that gap?
You know, I'm sure you've heard this before, Vicki, but there is power in listening. And when someone comes to you, someone you love or someone that you really care about, or perhaps even, you know, it's happened before, these are individuals that just need someone to connect with, you listen and you believe them. And I think many of us can really identify with those moments in our lives where perhaps we are engaging in a situation that may be confusing or painful, but what you're really looking for is for someone to just hold that space for you. So truly listening and being present without needing to fix, without needing to jump to the next step, is truly the most powerful thing we can do for the people in our lives.
Right. Just being there without expectations.
Correct.
The journey of trauma is also crucial to keep in mind. And we learned during the podcast that one of the most painful things to hear following an assault, and it could be months or years later, is, aren't you over it yet? You know, someone from the outside, a loved one, essentially telling them that there should be an expiration date to healing. You know, that's a big no-no, but what are other big no-nos to avoid?
Oof, I mean, we've definitely heard that before, and I don't know if I want to frame them as no-nos, but, you know, this idea, that example that you just brought up, oh, it's been 2 years, shouldn't you be over it? Or you've had X experiences, so why are you still living in that? Or so much good has happened in your life since then. Why are you still kind of remembering that? Trauma is complex. And for us to believe that we can cure it or resolve it is false. And it appears in places where you probably thought it wouldn't come up. So it could be years later, it could be in a specific setting, it could be a scent, it could be anything that the word that sometimes is used is triggers certain feelings of being abused or being harassed once again. So it's very difficult to know as an individual even what those experiences are going to be until they happen. So truly, it's a little bit hurtful for someone you love to tell you, get over it, when you yourself feel this pain so deeply. And being flexible or being understanding of that, I don't think is that hard. I think we all as human beings know what it feels like to experience pain or harm and want people to be there for us. But you're right, the prevalence is incredibly high. Sometimes we think that although sexual assault is so highly underreported, about 1 in 2 women, 1 in 4 men are going to experience sexual assault in their lifetimes. So the odds that you're even speaking to someone who has a lived experience as a sexual assault survivor or knows someone very close to them who has is very great. So our interactions with one another will be informed by that if we understand that.
You know, listening is such a big foundation of all of this, right? And listening and without expectations. But if you want to offer support and also just let someone you love know that you're there to also discuss trauma, but you want to avoid re-traumatizing, how do you navigate that?
Well, it certainly wouldn't be, going back to your no-nos, is getting into someone's space and saying, hey, talk to me. So each individual has the right to tell their story when they're ready to tell their story and has the right to change their mind about telling their story. And that's something that I really want to, a point I want to drive home. But more so this idea that you mentioned of almost signaling that you're someone who listens or someone who is attuned to that conversation is so much about modeling that behavior. You know, one of the examples I heard recently or saw play out, especially as we were sheltering in place and using social media so heavily, was that anytime we saw in the news that there was some sort of sexual assault allegation against a celebrity or about a celebrity, every time we saw individuals dismiss that account or say, this person couldn't have possibly been honest, or this person is clearly looking for X, Y, and Z, the celebrity is never going to see that tweet or that post. But the people who follow you, your friends and family who see your social media, do see that. And they're the ones who then receive the message, this person may not believe me. So our behavior in these spaces, the way we interact with our friends, the jokes we tell, people are listening and we have greater influence than we give ourselves credit for.
Yeah. Yeah, we're talking generally about relationships, but to get more specific, because this was addressed in the podcast series, for romantic relationships, there's navigating intimacy and navigating a new dynamic of a relationship. What particular advice do you have for those types of relationships?
Oh boy. I mean, so much of the work that we do as well, and the conversations that I love having, that I feel are the richest, is with young folks. When we talk about what we call interpersonal violence, or really, you know, some of the it's beyond miscommunication that happens, especially within our own relationships. And I don't think that's something that happens more with younger people or as you get older. There's just this need for communication between people. And there are a lot of assumptions also being made. So we're all raised differently. We're all we all have different behaviors that are modeled for us as well. But if this is a new relationship, every relationship is a new relationship, truly. You're going to have to talk it out. You're going to have to be able to express that something was not okay. And for many of the survivors that have come forward as well, they didn't even realize that some of the behaviors within their relationship were unhealthy until years later when we are having these conversations and they think back, oh, this is why I didn't feel quite okay with something so long ago. So being able to give it a name is also very important. And I'm starting to see that play out a little bit more in the media. I'm starting to see that conversations between our advocates and survivors are certainly able to ascribe a name to some of these behaviors or things that have happened to them. But you talk about being more specific. A lot of the language that we see is around consent, right? And this idea that if people want to engage with you, if your partner wants to engage in a certain act, that you should be asking and they should be checking in. But the idea of sexual violence, or at least this miscommunication only happening in a setting where sex is happening, is only part of the conversation. Consent is played out. It's almost like a muscle. You have to learn how to ask and receive and affirm consent in all of your interactions throughout your life. And that means, you know, even the way that you make plans with your partner. Did you consider that they had other ideas? Did you consider their schedule and their time? And this practice of consent, yes, you're okay going to this place. No, not today. Yes, I'd like to do this with you. I'd like to meet other people with you, is a practice that then does kind of dive into this more intimate spaces. But I think, you know, being able to interact with someone else is tricky, but incredibly enriching. And so that's truly something that we would, especially for myself, something that even I have to practice, is what does communication and consent look like in all elements of my relationship with that person, not just when I'm alone with them.
Yeah, that is great advice, just having a wider lens and perspective with all of this. Carissa Gutierrez is with Valoras, a national organization based in Sacramento, committed to advancing equity and ending sexual violence. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Becky.
And that was my conversation with Carissa Gutierrez, the former communications director for Valoras, a national nonprofit that is working to end sexual violence. To learn more, you can subscribe to CAP Radio's After the Assault podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. For more resources, including a list of support organizations and what to expect if you choose to report a sexual assault, visit capradio.org/after. That is it for Insight Today. A special thanks to Jessica Mariah Ross, who directed CAP Radio's After the Assault podcast and helped edit today's show. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.